Thanks, Brother Jeff, and good evening, my dear brethren and sisters and young people. Well, at our last class, we saw turmoil in the house of the patriarchs. At the time when Joseph was taken and sold into Egypt, which is where we're picking up our record from in chapter 39, verse 1 tonight, in the house of the patriarchs, as they were at that stage, there was tension and hatred, there was deceit and violence and cruelty and unselfishness. There were many in that family that were racked with immorality and greed. It's a terrible picture that we get. That's the ecclesia of God, those who'd been called out, the followers of the promises that had been given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as Joseph is taken by his own brethren, not by people in the world, and sold into slavery, God pulls back the curtain past chapter 38 and allows us to see just what was going on. And the reason for that, we saw in our last class, was the reason for this unreasonable circumstance that was facing Joseph at this time, as he's being so badly treated by his brethren, and now sold by his brethren into the hand of the Midianites to go into slavery, is that God was going to work through this godly young man to turn his brethren and his whole family back again. Because God was in control of this whole set of circumstances. And it's such a difficult thing for us to see, isn't it, in our own lives. And it was certainly an exceedingly difficult thing for Joseph to see in his life. It was a difficult thing for Jacob to see after his all of his experiences in Padan Aram. It was still a difficult thing for him to see the hand of God working and what, in fact, God was trying to achieve in all those things. And yet God was going to prepare Joseph by taking him into Egypt, as we know. We know the end of the story, don't we, brothers and sisters? But if we just try and have a look at just what Joseph thought and must have felt at the time, we will find a great deal of exhortation and comfort, and that's what we hope to do tonight. Because Joseph was going into Egypt, in fact, to prepare him to be in a position to save his brethren. Well, we know that chapter 39 is just slotted in, because right at the end of chapter 37 and the first verse of chapter 39 are almost the same. And then we pick up the story. It's as if the divine penman said, well, as if you can't quite remember where we took the break, let's just repeat this in verse 1 of chapter 39. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down hither. So he comes down to Egypt. Of course, at the time, he probably didn't know where he was going, unless there was some conversation there going on when, at the time he was being sold, and they were saying that they were possibly going down to Egypt. But whether he found out then, when he was being bargained with his brother, with the brothers and the Ishmaelites, or whether he found out later that he was actually heading for Egypt, it must have had a dramatic effect upon the mind of this sensitive young man. Because, And it's emphasised here that he's going down to Egypt. You notice he doesn't just tell us in verse 1 that he's going down to Egypt, but when he gets there, he gets into the house of an Egyptian. And all the way through this chapter, we've got this emphasis on Egypt and the Egyptian. In fact, three times we're told Potiphar's an Egyptian. I don't think we really needed to be told three times, but it's trying to emphasise something. In verse 1, verse 2, verse 5, it tells us that he was an Egyptian. And what do you think Joseph's reaction might have been to when he found out that he was actually in Egypt or was heading towards Egypt? Well, this was the godly seed that had come through the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He was probably the only one of all those brothers who knew in detail and who was interested in the history of the nation, the history of their fathers and grandfathers and so on, and all the promises that had been given. No doubt those other children, the other sons in that family had heard some of that, but to them, they didn't really want to know at this stage anything much about it. But you know, Joseph must have actually thought back when he found out that he's going to Egypt, that the only time that Abraham went down to Egypt, it was an absolute disaster. And what else came out of Egypt? It was a place to be avoided because Hagar came from Egypt. She was called the bondwoman. And then from her came Ishmael, and the very descendants of that man, who was an Egyptian, because he went back to Egypt to get a wife, so he married an Egyptian wife, he had an Egyptian mother, and now the descendants of him are the ones that are carrying them down into Egypt. What an amazing story this is. Why all this connection with Egypt here? Why? Well, not only is this connection through Ishmael here, but we know that Isaac was told in a vision by God that no doubt Joseph knew about. He was told to not go down into Egypt, but to dwell in the land. And that's exactly what Joseph wanted to do. He wanted nothing else but to stay at Hebron, the very place that Abraham had finally found fellowship with God, where his father, after many years in Padan Aram, had finally come back to. That's exactly where he wanted to be. And because he goes out to seek his brethren, they take him off. And now the Ishmaelites carry him down into Egypt. It's certainly not a place. It's the last place on earth that he wanted to be, because he knew what Egypt stood for. He knew that Egypt was not the place he wanted to be. Egypt was a place where trouble had always come from in the history of that family. And it continued to be so in the history of the nation after this. What did Egypt stand for? Well, we know very well that Egypt later particularly was a symbol of bondage and slavery to sin and death. And here we find that even though he comes down into Egypt, it's not just by chance he happens to get sold to anyone in Egypt. You know, even the royal house at this time were not Egyptians, they were foreigners. But he doesn't go into the house of Pharaoh. He goes into the house of an Egyptian. And we're told three times that happens, that he's sold into the hands of an Egyptian. And Potiphar was his name. In fact, we only find his name here in verse 1 and back in chapter 37. His name's not used again throughout all this chapter, and it's interesting to see what he's called. You know, the Spirit is discerning in the way it uses terms, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But Potiphar's name means a servant of Ra, or servant of the sun. He was the chief of the executioners, general to Pharaoh, as we find out from all the details that are given to us. He tells us all that information to start with and doesn't repeat that information again. Now, as Joseph gets down there and he finds out that he's been sold to the chief of the executioners, to a high-ranking general in Pharaoh's court, you can imagine, with all that was going through his mind about what Egypt stood for, how afraid and humiliated he must have felt. Just imagine him going through a slave market where slaves were paraded, probably naked, and sold to the highest bidder. And he's a sensitive and godly young man who had done nothing wrong, and he's now down there in the midst of all that. It's a terribly dark picture, isn't it? It's something we don't want to dwell on for too long, and the experience and anguish of this young boy. Now no freedom, no rights. He's owned by someone now. There's no opportunity for him now to serve himself. Not that he was a man that was doing that. His brothers certainly were. But you know, I think that's really very important in this story. And we're going to come back to that in a couple of studies' time. When the whole story comes together, there's something extremely important about where he went to start with and the fact that he became a slave in the house of an Egyptian, lost all his rights and all his ability to serve himself. And yet, having seen that dark picture of him arriving in Egypt with all those emotions that must have been going around his mind, verse 2 says, and Yahweh was with Joseph. It's just like a breath of fresh air comes into this record, a ray of sunshine that just lightens everything up. And he was a prosperous man. He was there in the house of his master, the Egyptian. You know, was that apparent when he first arrived that Yahweh was with him? It must have appeared Exactly the opposite. It must have appeared to him as though God had forsaken him forever. That why on earth would God ever let him go down into a place and go through the experiences and the humiliation that he was actually going through at the time? He'd been kidnapped and sold by his own brethren, now bought as a slave. He's in a strange country. He doesn't understand the language. And he's now owned lock, stock and barrel by someone else. What was he to do? And yet, you know, I think this verse gives us a bit of a clue. Because it says, he was a prosperous man and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. You know, Potiphar is always called his master in this record from here on. He always calls Potiphar his master. Potiphar's wife calls him Joseph's master, because the key to his survival in this circumstance, brethren and sisters, was him accepting what God had brought upon him. He'd been bought by this man, and from then on he accepted it as his master. He was his master. He treated him like his master. And immediately it was evident that Yahweh was blessing him and that he was with him and that he was prosperous or successful, as verse two, the word prosperous in verse 2 actually means. But I'd like you to come over to 2 Chronicles 15. We all know this passage well, but I think it's worth us just turning it up and having a look. 2 Chronicles 15. You know, this is an exceedingly important little verse tucked away in the historical record of the Chronicles. And we know that it was Azariah, the prophet, who came to Asa in 2 Chronicles 15 and verse 2. And said, verse 2 says, and he went out to meet Asa, and he said unto him, hear ye me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. Yahweh is with you while ye be with him. And if ye seek him, he will be found of you. But if ye forsake him, he will forsake you. You know, the reason why immediately the record of Joseph upon coming through those dark experiences and landing in Egypt, the reason it immediately tells us that Yahweh is with him is because Joseph himself was seeking earnestly. He never, ever wanted to leave God, ever. And now we find him, God saying, I'll be found of you if you seek me. I'll only forsake you if you forsake me. And there in the darkest moment of his life to this point of time, as he arrives in that unknown land, we find the divine penman telling us something about this young man. Oh, it's telling us that Yahweh was with him, you know, but it tells us a lot more than that. It tells us that Joseph was seeking God, because Yahweh would never have been with him unless he was seeking. But while you've got your hand in 2 Chronicles 15, just let's read on verse 3. Now, these words were said in the context of Asa's experience and his times. But you look at how significant this is. And it says, and now for a long season Israel hath been without the true God and without a teaching priest and without law. But when they in their trouble did turn unto Yahweh, God of Israel, and sought him, he was found of them. You know, this is almost a description of what's about to happen in Joseph's life. Oh, for a long season now, his whole family had been without God, without a law, they'd forsaken him. But when in their trouble they began to turn, and it was the start of the process that we see here now as Joseph goes into Egypt. The trouble hasn't yet really started, and the pressure hasn't really yet come upon those brothers. But it's going to come, and when it comes, they're going to begin to turn around again, turn back to Yahweh, and he will be found of them. We know the end of the story goes there, but God was going to need an individual who was an example, one who would prepare the way, one of the youngest in the family, as it turned out here. And he was going to put him through extreme circumstances in order that he might prepare the way so that the rest of his family might eventually turn around and come back to him. Well, come back to Genesis. You know, this phrase, Yahweh was with Joseph, that we read in verse 2, occurs, in fact, four times in this chapter. As Brother Gary was reading it, I wonder whether you noticed it, or if you haven't got them coloured, colour them, because they occur in verse 2, verse 3, and then over again in verse 21 and 23 at the end of the chapter. Yahweh was with Joseph because God was taken with him every day by Joseph. Do you know, brothers and sisters, I think that's an exceedingly interesting juxtaposition of ideas here between verses 1 and 2. Because it was a very dark moment in Joseph's life. And yet the divine record says that Yahweh was with him straight away. Now, whenever we're faced with difficulties or trials in our lives, brethren and sisters, when there's unjust circumstances, and that's exactly what Joseph was facing himself here, he'd been wrenched out and sold, having done nothing wrong. He was an absolutely innocent man, and he was guilty of nothing for all that came upon him. And yet, in those circumstances, the very first thing that we probably tend to do is ask, why me? And what is God doing? And where is God? And no doubt some of those things might have flashed through Joseph's mind. But you know, the record tells us that very quickly he focused back on where his source of strength was, and he understood and trusted, because Yahweh came in alongside Joseph immediately. He didn't stay in this questioning mode for too long, because he'd learned, even though he was only 17 or 18 at the time, he'd learned to just accept the circumstances that God was bringing upon him, even if he didn't understand them. You know, brothers and sisters, there's almost no trial or difficult circumstance or unjust circumstance that God brings in our lives where we do actually understand completely everything about it. If it's going to do us any good, we won't understand. It's the exercise of that unknown that brings patience and develops character. And God's doing it for that very reason. And so we shouldn't just think something strange happened to us. And Joseph here, though he must have had a range of emotions, very quickly brought himself back to rely on God. But you know, it's just such an amazing attitude here, isn't there, as we see. It's just an inspirational thing when we read the life of this young man. Because you can imagine the reactions that might have come for him to see that after all the things that had been done to him by his brothers. Well, if that's what the truth's all about, then I don't want anything to do with it. Because everything's going wrong. Was that to anything to do with the fact that the truth was the truth? He didn't blame his brethren either, did you notice? There's nothing of that. He didn't build up anger or hatred or grudges. He didn't go over and grind over those things. He didn't bemoan his lot. He didn't complain about being hard done by. He didn't even challenge God. It just says Yahweh was with him. Immediately, through that circumstance, Yahweh was with him. And yet he must have felt hurt and must have felt perplexed and must have felt in anguish of spirit. He couldn't be human and not feel those things. And yet, as we looked at Psalm 77, we're not going to turn to it now, but Psalm 77 is one of those psalms that just goes through the whole range of emotions as the psalmist tries to grapple with what God is doing in his life. And he asks the question, has God forgotten to be gracious? But as he thinks about all that's going on, he eventually comes to the point where he says, I will remember the works of Yahweh and the wonders of old. For thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people. And it was that very confidence that he rested on in the end. You know, brothers and sisters, that's what faith is all about, real faith. That's faith in action against all odds. Faith is not something where we just believe something. Faith is faith when, against all odds, we can still hang on. When it's impossible to understand how this is working out or how it's going to work out, and we still believe that God's in control. And that's where he got to. And he's only 18 years of age. You know, brothers and sisters, God will take every son and daughter that he calls down that path. Somehow we tend to think sometimes that that we can still have faith and sit comfortably in our armchairs. Well, God will show us otherwise, brethren and sisters, and he'll take us through the valley of tears, like he took Joseph here, through the valley of uncertainty and anguish and sorrow and hurt, in order that we might learn to trust, not in ourselves, because we don't really know what's best, but in he who created us in the first place. You know, the Apostle Peter, and we're not going to turn to this, we'll go to Peter a little later. But the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter 4 said, talking to the brethren and sisters of those days who were going through some very difficult trials, things that had suddenly come upon them, unjustly. It's very clear from 1 Peter that they were unjust, that there were many things that had happened to the ecclesia that they didn't deserve, and yet they just rolled over them and had overtaken them. They were finding it difficult to cope with all of those things. And he writes to them very gently. He says, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you." You know, I think Joseph had already, at the age of 17 and 18, had actually understood from talking to his father, from seeing what had happened, from talking to his grandfather and so on, and hearing the stories that had gone through with the patriarchs and the way God had dealt with them. He understood that there was difficult times to be faced, and when they came, it might not be very easy to understand, but it didn't mean that God was not there. He understood the principle that the Apostle Paul later enunciated. A beautiful little phrase, brethren and sisters, that all things work together for good to those that love him. All things. You know, brothers and sisters, we all understand that in principle, don't we? But it's a very different thing when a very severe set of circumstances or trials starts to hit our lives. It's a very different thing to actually believe that all things, all the difficult things, all the hurt, all the heartache, all the pain, all the anguish, the uncertainty, all is working for our good. Well, Joseph at 17 accepted that. And he believed, like Paul went on to say in Romans 8, that if God is for us, who can possibly be against us? You know, the trial of Joseph's faith started out in very ordinary circumstances within his family. And they continued to involve him personally in the circumstances that he was in. First of all, in the house in which he lived. And then he was domiciled in a prison, and there again, it all happened again. And yet, the record tells us here that he was a successful man, verse 2. And verse 3, and his master saw that Yahweh was with him, and that Yahweh made all that he did to prosper in his hands. Even though he was in the house of an Egyptian now, we find that his faithfulness and his trust in God had led to an honest and positive service. So much so that his master even noticed. His master saw that Yahweh was with him. That's an extremely interesting phrase, isn't it, brothers and sisters? What did Potiphar actually see, do you think? It says he saw that Yahweh was with him, but he didn't see Yahweh, did he? What did he see? He saw probably an organized house. He saw increased production. He sort of saw better organization. He saw harmony within the house. He saw a wonderfully willing spirit of dedication above the call of duty. This servant doing things that he didn't even really ask him to do, anticipating things that needed to be done. Joseph, he saw Joseph as a very special servant. But how did he see that Yahweh was with him? I don't think there's any doubt at all, that Joseph had told Potiphar that he believed that Yahweh was with him. No doubt he told him some of the story. He told him where he'd come. We find that Potiphar's wife knew where he'd come from a little later. And, you know, it's a very great challenge, isn't it, that his master saw that Yahweh, what did Potiphar know of Yahweh before he met this man? But now Potiphar knows an awful lot about the God of the fathers. He knows that this God, the God of these fathers, is such a powerful God that it changes the lives of individuals into amazing servants. And things just happen. Everything goes right in his house. And he's feeling more prosperous. And we find out as he goes on that God blessed the house of the Egyptian for Joseph's sake. We're told in verse 5. This is an amazing thing as Joseph now preaches the truth to him. Not just in word, though he must have told him who Yahweh was. He must have told him about him being a Hebrew and where he'd come from. But you know, brothers and sisters, I think there's a tremendous challenge there for all of us. I just wonder how many, when we read that verse, verse 3, and verse 4 too as well, just how many of our bosses, our supervisors, our workmates would ever say that Yahweh was with us? Oh, sometimes our bosses or workmates might actually see that we're different. They might even think we're just a little strange. But you know, Potiphar didn't actually think this man was strange. He was attracted to him because of what he did and what he told him. And we know this in the record of Joseph, and it's worth just making a note of this and chasing them up. I'm not going to give you chapter and verse at the moment. That Joseph spoke the truth to Potiphar, to Potiphar's wife, to the butler, to the baker, to the ruler of the prison, and even to Pharaoh himself. And every single one of those people were left not with the impression that this is an unusual person. They were drawn to him. They wanted him in their company. You know, that's an amazing thing. And because we read on that verse 4 says, and Joseph found grace in his sight. That's Potiphar's. He found favour in the sight of Potiphar, and he served him. And he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. It came to pass from the time that he'd made him overseer of his house and over all that he had, that Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of Yahweh was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. You know, there's this beautiful little principle in Proverbs chapter 3. Let's just go there a minute. Proverbs 3. That jumps really out of here. It's an echo of just one phrase in that verse, verse 4. Joseph found grace or favour in his sight. Found grace in his sight. Now, we already know in verse 2 and 3 that Joseph had already found favour in God's sight because he's blessing him. He's with him, we're told. But in Proverbs 3, the wise man says, verse 3 of Proverbs 3, let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thine heart. So shalt thou find favour and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Now we know that those words are picked up, well, from here and used of the Lord Jesus Christ when he was a child. In fact, they're taken probably first from back in the life of Samuel, where a similar phrase is actually used. Found favour in the sight of God and man. But it's not a very common phrase that's used of individuals. But here we find that Joseph has already found favour in the sight of God, and now he's found favour in the sight of Potiphar as well. And we know in the sight of Pharaoh, and we know in the sight of the keeper of the prison, and in the butler, and in the baker. So he's finding grace or favour in the sight of men and God. And the key, Solomon said, was letting mercy and truth, that perfect balance of God's character, being hung around our neck, adorning our lives, and written on the table of our hearts. It was the evident sincerity of this young man and the beautiful balance of his character that had attracted both God and man. And not only that, verse 4 says, and he served him. It almost seems a superfluous phrase in this record here, and he served him. What's it telling us? It's telling us that he was happy to serve him. He found grace in his sight, and he served him. He was happy to be a servant. You know, we haven't got time now, but make a note of, in your margin there, of Ephesians 6, verses 5 to 8. There's another passage in Colossians 3, and I can't remember the exact verses, but Ephesians 6, verses 5 to 8, which we don't have time to turn up now, is just a wonderful description of the attitude of service that all of us ought to have, brothers and sisters, because service to a master is service to God and Christ. You know what Paul calls it? He calls it the doing of the will of God. And clearly, Joseph saw that. And when he saw that he had been sold into the house of an Egyptian master, he made that his service to God. He could do nothing else about it. God had put him in that circumstance. He was unable to run away. He was unable to defy his master, and he accepted it and served him with great diligence and a willingness that all of us probably have got reason to learn from. And in the process, preached the truth, not only to Potiphar, but to everyone else in that house. You know, it's no different. It's absolutely no different today. There's no question that if we are diligent in our work, that our associates will actually see and notice. They'll notice. But whether they ever take that final step to know that Yahweh is with us is determined by what we do and say to them. Let's read on. We've just read verse 5 and verse 6. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught that he had save the bread that he did eat. So now this right spirit that Joseph was manifesting had brought not only blessing to the house, it had brought success, it had brought promotion. You know, Joseph could have thought, well, okay, I'll soon be out of here. I'm just going up the ladder here. And soon I'll be able to buy my way out of here. But we find no such desire, no such spirit. He knew that God had brought him to this point, and that had placed him as a servant in that house, and he was happy to serve until the time that God would change those circumstances. Notice that it says there in verse 5 that Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Why are we told that? That, I think, brethren and sisters, was an encouragement to Joseph more than the Egyptian. Why did the Egyptian need to know? Well, he was very impressed because he saw his own wealth going up and things going well in his own house and much more organized and much more productive. But Yahweh was blessing that house for Joseph's sake, to give Joseph some encouragement that he was doing the right thing and that God was still actually with him. And then at the end of verse 6, we find that Joseph was a goodly person and well favoured. That phrase is translated in the RSV, he was handsome and good looking. It's exactly the same phrase that's used of his mother in Genesis 29 and verse 17. So we know that Jacob was attracted to her because of her looks, and now we find that in Joseph was obviously at the age of he's obviously been in the house of Potiphar now for some time, and he's come up through the ranks and he's been given authority over the house, and he's now the ruler of that house. He's organizing all the things that are in that house. So how old he is, we don't know. Probably in his early 20s, maybe as late as his mid-20s, but certainly no older than that. Because we're not given any indication exactly of time here. But he's a handsome and good-looking young man. And verse 7 immediately goes on to say, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. You know, Joseph had everything going for him at this time. He was not only handsome and good-looking, as the record tells us. He was intelligent and capable. He was successful, because we're told that as well. and he'd been placed in a position of honour in that house. And everything was going right. And at that very moment, this unexpected trial lands into his life. He's in a foreign land. He doesn't know. He's got no connections with any of the people there. And he's propositioned by his master's wife. Did you notice there that it says that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph? I think it tells us that. It doesn't tell us that it's Potiphar's wife. It's his master's wife. Because that's exactly the relationship that Joseph always had with this woman. He was his master's wife. He had reverence and respect for his master. He had reverence and respect and position for his master's wife. There was no familiarity here on his part. This was nothing to do with him. And often it is, brethren and sisters, that upon success or when times have been good and when things are going fine, temptation arises in our lives. Well, this put enormous pressure on him. But reading on in verse 8, it says, but he refused. He's in a foreign land. There was no one who knew him. This was, in a sense, something that he may well have indulged in and got away with. But the record is very strong. He refused and he said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is in me with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand, and there is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And there's three reasons there, brethren and sisters, that he gave to her in arguing with her and telling her, no, this wasn't to be the case. And we know that he told her more than this because she actually understood that he was a Hebrew later. He said, first of all, that my master, that's what he calls him, my master trusts me and I can't betray that trust. My master has put everything in my hand except for you and I'm not going to touch that because he said. And the last and greatest reason, this is great wickedness, and I will not sin before God. You know, that's a tremendous insight into the mind and the character of this young man, a man of tremendous integrity and honesty, personal integrity and honesty, in a situation where he was putting real pressure was coming to bear upon him, where he may very well have been attracted to her. He himself was at the prime of his manhood, and yet he was so convicted about divine standards that what God said and what God thought was more important than what he thought. You know, brothers and sisters, we've got to be very careful because we're living in an age where the humanistic spirits, the unclean spirits like frogs that are pervading all of our society, that we know was going to be a feature of the latter days. This humanistic reasoning spirit is robbing us of the sharpness of Joseph's understanding. He saw that if God thought that, that was it. This was great wickedness. Oh, there was no reasoning and weaving around and trying to make some sort of compromise or make excuses. He had every excuse under the sun to commit fornication with that woman. His whole family was riddled with it. And yet here, though he'd been sold into slavery by them all, he stood up, aware every day of the presence of God with him, of the reality of God in his life. You know, four times it tells us that God was with him. That's why he said no. He was a man of integrity and he respected his master. But in the end, it came down to what God actually thought, because every day of his life, he took God with him. And it didn't matter whether there was another Christadelphian within 500 kilometres. Didn't matter that his brethren were hundreds of miles away. Didn't matter, because God was with him. You know, we get an indication as to what was in his mind when you look at the record. It's a very interesting exercise to start at Genesis 37, go right through to the end of the book of Genesis, which is, record is all about Joseph's life, and to just highlight all the sections where Joseph says something. And you know what you'll find? That every time Joseph opens his mouth, he's talking about God or his visions or his word. Every time the record talks, opens Joseph's mouth and he has something to say, there is something about God or the visions that he'd given to him. It's quite amazing because it's telling us where his mind was and that every day God was with him because he was with God. You know, it's, the Proverbs have got quite a lot to say. Here's just a couple of passages in the Proverbs that clearly are relevant in this particular circumstance. Proverbs 16 says, "By the fear of Yahweh, men depart from evil." That was the key to Joseph's refusal of this woman. By the fear of Yahweh, men depart from evil. And where we don't fear Yahweh, brothers and sisters, if we don't have enough respect for him, we'll fall into sin often. But the fear of God will keep us from sin. He that walketh in his uprightness fears Yahweh, Proverbs 14 says. The way of Yahweh is strength to the upright. The highway of the upright is to depart from evil. And we find here Joseph's example as being quite amazing. You know, the temptation's often not quite that simple. Because verse 10 tells us, "It came to pass as she spake to Joseph day by day that he hearkened not unto her to lie with her or to be with her." There was subtle, persistent, continual pressure. It wasn't just a one-off thing. It went on and on and on. And we know the effect when sin goes on and on and on. And there are many examples in the Bible. One that just comes to mind is Samson, who was worn down by the continual pressure of the same problem. You know, brothers and sisters, if we're facing the continual temptation of the same problem time and again, it's likely that we are going to get worn down and capitulate. But look, we've got an amazing example in this young man. Look what it tells us in verse 9. "And he hearkened not unto her." He just turned a deaf ear and walked away to lie with her or to be with her. You see, there were three things there. His response was not to argue with that temptation anymore. He'd given all the reasons and it had bounced off like a brick wall. It was not going to impress that woman. It was not going to stop her advances. And it didn't matter how much more he told her about the truth or about his God, it wasn't going to do any good. He had to make some action and he started to move away. He moved right out of her way. He avoided her. He made sure that he was not there when she was. But he was in that house. He was a servant in that house and he couldn't actually get out of that. So he avoided every situation he possibly could. You know, brothers and sisters, that's a biblical principle that Paul takes up. Let's go over to Romans 13 for a moment. Because it's a very important principle. Romans 13. Verse 12. There the apostle says, "The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. And let us walk honestly, as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness and chambering and wantonness, nor in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." And here Joseph has not only put on his armour every day, there was no problem in him doing that. Now he's having to make no provision for the flesh and trying to avoid everything. But the time came, brothers and sisters, when even that wasn't sufficient. Come back to Genesis. And in verse 11 it says, "And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business. And there was none of the men in the house there within. And she caught him by his garment and said, 'Lie with me.' He left his garment with her in her hand and fled and got him out. And it came to pass when she saw that he'd left his garment in her hand and it fled forth, that she called unto the men of the house," and so on. So there came a time in Joseph's life here, in this experience in this house, when there was no other option but capitulate or flee. And he decided to flee. You know, it's very interesting there that it tells us that there was none of the men in the house there within. What's that telling us? It's telling us that no one would ever have known that even if he had capitulated at this moment of time, no one would ever have known. He was in a position, and so was she, where nothing would ever get out. But that wasn't the issue. God was there. And he left his garment, did you notice? And he fled and got him out. That's a bit superfluous. He left his garment in her hand. He fled and got him out. It tells us something about the way he's thinking. He is going to just get out of that whole place. He knew that. He didn't try to persuade her anymore. He didn't try to argue. He didn't try to rationalize or compromise. Just out. Flee. You know, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians. Let's go there. We know this passage well. But it's interesting in the context. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We know the context of 1 Corinthians 10 is Israel's failure. Failure in the wilderness and through a number of grievous sins, including idolatry and fornication, the very thing that Joseph now finds himself faced with. Verse 11. "Now all these things happen unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." That was exactly the circumstance that faced Joseph to start with. "There hath no temptation taken you as such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it." Well, it seems as though Paul here may even have Joseph in mind, because he goes on to say there in verse 14, "Flee idolatry." And there's really nothing else you can do except take that way of escape. You know, what it doesn't say, brethren and sisters, in verse 13, is that God will remove the temptation. God doesn't ever promise to remove the temptation. Nor does he actually even promise to ease it. What he does promise to do is to make a way of escape. But we have to choose it. Now you just stop and think about Joseph's way of escape. There he is, having been put on this pressure coming on him and on him and on him to capitulate, to give in against his conscience. And his conscience is standing firm. And it gets to the point where eventually he can't stand this any longer. And she grabs him. What's he to do? Well, he leaves his garment and runs out. He's now standing outside of the house with no outer garment. And as inside that house, there is an angry, hurt woman with revenge in her heart and a garment in her hand. That way of escape, brethren and sisters, appeared to be absolutely certain suicide. And yet, it was the way of escape that God provided. You know, what we tend to think when we read that verse is that God somewhere along the line is going to make some nice easy path. If we just wait long enough, God's going to make some nice easy path and we'll just be able to slip out with no hurt. Don't ever think that. You look at every example you can ever find in the scriptures where people had to flee out of temptation, and it was a painful decision. You take our Lord Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's under great temptation, the greatest hour of his temptation, and he's praying earnestly to his Father to overcome, and the Father sends an angel down to strengthen him. That's all he does. And there's a way of escape possible. He does not have to give in to the flesh. And the angel encourages him with all kinds of examples. And the Father is encouraging him in that way. But he doesn't make an easy way of escape. What was the way of escape? Finally, Christ came and made that decision in himself to take it. He said, "Rise, let us be going," and he walked straight into the arms of the guard, who took him, thrashed him, beat him, tried him, and hung him on a cross. That was the way of escape. So let's never think that the way of escape's easy, or that it's just going to be there for us to roll down the hill and get away. God will always make a way of escape, but we have to make a constant decision that we're actually going to take that. You know, in Joseph's mind, there was no doubt that this was wrong. And as Paul later said in 1 Corinthians 6, in fact, he said, "Flee fornication," to a generation in his day that was riddled with immorality. What are the lessons for our generation, brethren and sisters? We're living in a generation that Jesus said was a wicked and adulterous generation, where values of right and wrong are all upside down, where we're blasted if we allow it, we're blasted by the media with everything that's perverse and evil and contorted and twisted, and our children are being bombarded by all those sort of things. And God says, make no provision for the flesh. It is God's will, 1 Thessalonians 4, it is God's will that you be sanctified and pure and holy. What does that mean in practice? Well, Joseph took the way of escape. Lot didn't. Lot could have and should have got out. And sometimes, brethren and sisters, we're more like Lot than we are like Joseph. We've got to learn to avoid the places and circumstances and influences that are going to pull us into sin. And if we think that we can fight and that we've got enough strength to fight against the media of this world, we are utterly self-deceived. If we think that we're going to fight against the bombardment of humanistic thinking, of immorality that comes through radio and television and movies and the internet and magazines, we are deceiving ourselves, brothers and sisters. Young people, don't ever think we're going to stand up to that unless we make some absolute decisions to restrict our lives. Joseph would never have tolerated any of that. God makes a way of escape. We have choices that we can make, and we need to take them. You know, it doesn't just have to apply to immorality here, brethren. It can apply to any form of temptation. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. There is, in the end, no other safeguard against temptation than the strengthening of our consciences before God and making no provision for the flesh. What we've got to do in our lives is do what Joseph did. Make God so real that he's there every day with us, that we take him with us, that our great desire is to please him and to obey him. And it doesn't matter if there's no men in the house. It doesn't matter if no one can see us or no one knows, because God's there. This man is an absolute inspiration. And he's only in his 20s. Especially considering his own family, where Reuben had gone down this path, and Bilhah, and Judah, and Dinah, and Ur, and Onan, all of them had succumbed. And here he's in Egypt, upon their wicked plotting.
and he's standing like a palm tree. And do you notice what Potiphar's wife said? Let's come back to Genesis for a moment. Verse 14. She called unto the men of the house and spake unto them, saying, "See, he hath brought an Hebrew unto us to mock us. And he came in to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice." All these lies and deception now, that this story that comes forth to hide her evil desires. Amazing. Where did she get that from? Why did she call him a Hebrew? You know why she called him a Hebrew? Because she knew that the reason she was not unable to snare him is because he was a Hebrew. And he'd made it very, very clear that he was. You know, he is only the second person in the Bible to be called a Hebrew, Joseph. Abraham is called a Hebrew once in Genesis 14. But three times in the record we find Joseph being called a Hebrew, twice by Potiphar's wife and once by the butler. In fact, he himself tells the butler that he was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. He never said, "I came from the land of Canaan," which the butler would have understood. He said, "I came from the land of the Hebrews." Well, it's telling us that Joseph isn't an Egyptian, and there was no way he was ever going to be one. He had been in that land now for some time and had been successful, and others were now respecting him. And there was still a very clear demarcation, the very clear line in his mind about what he was telling people. He was a Hebrew, and he maintained that all his days, brothers and sisters. He eventually became the prime minister of Egypt and for many years ruled that nation. And the very last thing he said before he died is, "Get my bones and put them in a box and take them back into the land. I don't want them to stay in Egypt. I'm not an Egyptian. I'm a Hebrew. I want to go back. I don't belong here." And at no time ever did he ever belong to Egypt. It's why there's so much emphasis on Egyptian here. But you notice in verse 16, she laid up his garments by her until his Lord came home. She knew what respect he had for her husband, even if she didn't herself. And then all the lies and deceit come out. This unjust, unfair, untrue things that she said. And what chance did he have of answering any of it? He was like a lamb dumb. He could say nothing. He was totally and absolutely innocent. In fact, his integrity was inspirational. And verse 20 says, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. And he was there in the prison. Just imagine. He'd been faithful to his master. He'd been upright, honourable before God. He's innocent. And now he's treated like a criminal. His fate uncertain. He could lose his life. And earlier he'd gone through a similar experience, had he not, being sold as a slave. Why did God allow it? Why, brothers and sisters, did God allow it? You know, this is at the heart of the story of Joseph. Why did God allow it? Joseph had no control over any of those circumstances that God brought him in. He was totally powerless at the hands of his brothers. He was totally powerless in the hands of Potiphar and in the prison. But why did God allow it to happen? Well, the first and most obvious reason is that this was the way of escape from Potiphar's wife. He was put into prison for his safety from her. The temptation was no longer there, and God fixed it. He took the way of escape, and God honoured it. But did you notice in verse 20 it says, "And he was there in the prison"? Oh, well, it said he put him into prison. "And he was there in the prison." It seems a bit trite to say that. And he was there in the prison, which just must have been how he actually felt. as he landed in there. Why am I here? Why am I still alive? He probably would have lost his head if he was any other man. But God tells us why God allowed it. Come to Psalm 105. Psalm 105. And at verse 17. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, whose feet they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron. Look at the margin. His soul came into iron. Until the time that his word came, the word of Yahweh tried him. He was sold as a servant first, later cast into prison, and his soul came into iron. With all the despair and devastation of spirit that that conjures. Until the time came. You know how long that time was? The time was about 12 years. Until the time came. The word of Yahweh tried him. Why did God try him, brethren and sisters? He had done nothing wrong. God wasn't punishing him, though. That's the issue. He was preparing him for a great work. Because we understand the purpose of trial, though at times we don't fare too well under it. It's not just a matter of God deciding whether we've got faith or not and seeing if our faith is real, and so he has to try it so that he sees whether we've got faith or we haven't got faith. That may emerge in trial. But it's more a preparation. It's more a purging, a purifying process that God is interested in our lives, to see if we will let go of our own selfish interests and ways and thinking and submit to him and allow him to be the ruler of our lives. And Joseph is learning. He hasn't learned it completely. He's not yet ready to take his brethren and guide them back to God. But God is working with him. You know, Joseph never ever forgot those dreams that God had given him. And they must have come back to his mind many, many times. And he didn't know how or when they would ever come to pass. But all he could do was patiently wait and go through the circumstances that God was bringing upon him in well-doing, waiting for that time. But why did God take him into prison? Apart from the obvious thing that it was a place probably where Potiphar's wife couldn't reach him. Well, where would God take him to prepare him, do you think? Would God put him into the lap of luxury in Pharaoh's court in order to prepare him for the work that lay ahead? To prepare him to turn his brethren around? To have an influence in Egyptian society as well as in his own family? Would God take him into the lap of luxury? We know he wouldn't. He took him into the very dregs, into the prison house, where he was going to be compassed with infirmity. Now just think for a moment of all the overtones this has for our Lord Jesus Christ. Compassed with infirmity, touched with the feelings of our infirmity. Because it was God's way to, through the experiences in that place, to help him learn what he needed to help his brethren. I'd like to conclude in Hebrews chapter 5. Let's go there. In Hebrews chapter 5. Because here in talking about our Lord Jesus Christ, the apostle says, verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, was heard in that he feared. And though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. He learned obedience by the things which he suffered. You know, brothers and sisters, if the Son of God, if it was necessary for God to take his own son, who was absolutely sinless, down the pathway of suffering, that he might learn obedience, by what method is he going to teach his brethren to obey? But by suffering. We know that as a principle, brethren and sisters, and we don't like it. And no doubt Joseph didn't like it either. But he knew that it was necessary. It's true, brethren and sisters, that in adversity we learn. We learn far more than we could ever learn in prosperity. But look at verse 9. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. You see, God was actually taking his own son through a process of purging, of purifying his character, of developing qualities in him that might finally make him perfect so that he could save his brethren. And Joseph is being taken through that very same path, and so are we. And one day we're going to be confronted with that one who has done it for us, who's influenced our lives. And we might find out that there are many others who have been influenced by ours as well. But what an amazing thing it is that Joseph was able to be so positive, as he was, as soon as he was in that prison. Again, the same wonderful spirit emerges. Acceptance at God's hand of whatever comes. Let's just read this in conclusion. It's the words of Brother Roberts. God afflicts, he says, with an object. When the object is accomplished, the affliction is eased. If men will commit themselves to him in well-doing, he will guide their steps and frame their way for comfort and well-being. It is where they leave him out of account and follow their own devices for their own purposes that he may leave them to be snared in their own way. Joseph was not of that class. He feared God, was afraid of sin, and God was protecting him in the midst of evil and slowly guiding his paths, like he will with us too, brethren and sisters, to exaltation and honour.